call this meeting of the House Elections Committee to order. There is a quorum present. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. There is one correction. The bill author on House File 3276 was incorrectly stated, so that will be corrected. Any other discussion into the minutes? Okay, seeing none, can I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Vernick, you made eye contact. Okay, so, all right, Representative Vernick has moved approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Okay, the minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 4068. Representative Kraft, if you could please come forward. I will move that House File 4068 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Would you like me to also move the DE1 amendment, Representative Kraft?
Yes, please, I would.
Okay, thank you. I will move the DE1 amendment. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you'd like?
Yes, it is.
Okay, any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is approved. The bill is in the shape you'd like. Representative Kraft, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am so excited to be before you with House File 4068, which builds on a bill I carried last session that became part of the Democracy for the People Act, and that was voter pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. This bill is quite simple. School districts today are required to provide voter registration forms in May and September each year to all students who will be eligible to vote in the next election. This is great. Love it. We should all want more young people to vote. So this bill is a simple bill that would have school districts provide paper or electronic voter registration applications to all students who are eligible to vote or pre-register. I just love this bill, because the sooner we can encourage young people to think of themselves as voters, the more likely they will make it a lifelong habit. And with young people, it's their future that we often debate, and I think we are all better off when they participate more in that debate. And remember that voter pre-registration has been shown to increase turnout in the 18 to 29 age bracket from 2% to 9%. So let's pass this simple bill and put Minnesota on the path to busting out of that range. And with that, I have some testifiers.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Kraft. I have three testifiers who've signed up. The first testifier is Tess Michalik. Please come forward. Have a seat at the table. When you're ready, just please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm very thankful for the opportunity to speak in front of you today. My name is Tess Michalik, and I'm a sophomore at St. Louis Park High School. As you know, last session, a democracy bill was passed, which included pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, and by October, around 2,000 teenagers were pre-registered. I would often talk with my friends about pre-registration, but I quickly noticed a pattern. Many didn't know how to pre-register. To investigate this pattern, for a law and public policy class at my school, I conducted a simple two-question poll and found that 84% of students were aware that that they could pre-register now or when they turned 16, but only 17.8% knew the steps or how to register. In 2022, Minnesota had the third highest voter turnout rate in the 18 to 29 age range in the country, yet this was still 26% lower than the overall voter turnout rate in the 2022 Minnesota midterm. This shows that young people know about pre-registration but may lack access to registration or pre-registration. I believe that House File 4068 would increase the voter pre-registration rate, which would in turn increase voter turnout among young people because youth are thinking of themselves as voters earlier. Additionally, this makes registration more accessible, especially to people who don't know how to register. It is imperative that the next generation are civically active to face current problems and future problems that may face our society. I'm not 16 yet, but when I turn 16, I'm excited to pre-register, and I think that this bill will make pre-registration easier for me and my peers. Thank you.
Thank you, Tess Michalik. The second testifier on the bill is Hala Henderson. Hala does not appear to be here. So the third testifier is Nicole Freeman. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and Representative Kraft. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. My testimony will be really brief today, but I wanted to share the office's support of this bill. Secretary Simon has really enjoyed since you all passed pre-registration in 2023, being able to add this to his conversation that he has with high school students as he travels around the state, and has had a really positive reception to pre-registration and the engagement that has brought to high school students. As Representative Kraft and the testifier before me mentioned, engaging young people is really important to create lifelong voters, and so I hope that you will support this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we can turn to member discussion. If Holla Henderson does show up, we can revert back to testimony. Any discussion? Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things I've been disappointed over recent elections is that during caucuses, it was extremely common to have students attending, and they would get project credit for participating in the caucus activity as an observer. They would discuss resolutions and other things, and I thought that was a great way a child, a young adult, a school person could participate and learn about our system. So I would hope that just beyond the registration in our schools, we could do some of the Erdahl civics focus and get them to explore and participate in some of the processes to see how the neighbors and et cetera. I did it at 17, and don't use me an example in case I didn't turn out right, but I do think that as you're becoming an adult, exposure is good. So I like the intent. I wish it was broader in engagement. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wong. Any further discussion or comments? Here's Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question. And is this going to add any additional, like, unfunded expenses to the schools, do you believe?
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair and Representative Altendorf. So there's a choice here that the voter forms can be provided in paper or electronically. So there's some flexibility. I guess you could say there might be some additional paper costs and duplicating for a school district that already has to do it already. So maybe there's a little bit of additional cost there, but I think, balance that with getting more young people engaged seems like a really good small investment, if there is such thing.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess just my concern is always, adding on to their load. I know, their workforce right now, they're short and underfunded. So, that would be my concern.
Thank you. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to go on record and say, and I'm sure you all can agree, how impressed we are. I was with the first testifier. Thank you.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Thank you, Representative Davis. Any additional member discussion or comments? Seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would echo the support of the initial testifier. I felt like I could be very short and just let her take over. So I would appreciate everyone's support on this bill. It's really important, anything we can do to get more young people involved.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. So with that, the bill is laid over. So thank you, Representative Kraft. Next up is House File 4679 from Representative Coulter. Representative Coulter, would you like to move that House File 4679 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Okay. And then you have an A1 amendment. Did you want to move that?
I think it would probably make more sense to describe the bill first and then move the amendment after that, so folks are clear on what's being changed.
Okay, sure. Proceed with your description, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So last year, as part of a policy bill that was brought forward from the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, one of the changes that was included was a definition of official action with regards to local governments, and that definition was put into law. And that is important for these purposes because that definition in part relates to how a lobbyist is defined. And you can see in this particular bill on lines 1.12 and 1.13 how that definition relates to the definition of a lobbyist. So the current definition is any action that requires a vote or approval by one or more elected local officials while acting in their official capacity, or an action by an appointed or employed local official to make, to recommend, or to vote on as a member of the governing body major decisions regarding the expenditure or investment of public money. As is often the case when new definitions are added to law, clarification has been needed. In this case, I think both to reflect the broad consensus of what lobbying really is and what it isn't, and to recognize the realities of who is engaging in these activities and what should require registration and reporting. And I should say that the Campaign Finance Board has done a fair amount of work on this over the last few months. But part of the reason this bill is being brought forward is to add additional clarity and to recognize that the Campaign Finance Board is, I think, pretty close to their limit for what they can achieve through rulemaking. So this bill really includes sort of two pieces. And section one, the language that is of most important, starts on line 2.28. And that just clarifies that individuals who provide sort of professional expertise, variables, opinions, data, advice, and so on in service of a lobbyist. So think, you know, an architect who designs a bridge or an engineer who designs a water treatment plant. Those folks are not themselves lobbyists. There is also a specific clarification for folks who support members of a collective bargaining unit who are directly engaged in the collective bargaining process. And then Section 2 requires the Campaign Finance Board to study and, if appropriate, make recommendations to the legislature about the definition of lobbyist and specifically what is appropriate at the state level, what is appropriate at the local level, and so on. As I sort of got more involved in this conversation, it became clear to me that this is a section of statute that has perhaps not been examined for quite some time. And I think it is probably due for an update. And in conversations, I felt that the most appropriate folks to examine that were the Campaign Finance Board, who can ultimately make recommendations to the legislature on if and how to change the law. So that is the essence of the bill. I do, as the chair mentioned, I do have the A1 amendment and would like to move that.
Representative Coulter's moved the A1 amendment. Please describe the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill has very much been a work in progress for some time, and I suspect will continue to be. And so this amendment just sort of gets at some other questions that have been raised. So on lines 1.3 through 1.13, there is just more clarity there around the definition of an employee of a political subdivision. Line 1.14 adds, or rather strikes language that to clarify that folks who urge others to communicate with elected officials do not themselves have to register as lobbyists. I should note that the costs incurred in paying for those activities would still have to be reported by the principal lobbyist. Lines 1.15 through 1.18 really just sort of clean up and clarify existing language in the bill. And lines 1.19 through 2.4 more or less just update language. So that is sort of the short version of the amendment and would appreciate members' support.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted. The bill's in the shape you'd like. Any further comments on the bill, or should we turn to testifiers?
Yep.
Okay, I have a couple people who've signed up. The first is Kyle Makarios. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Good morning. My name is Kyle Makarios, and I'm here on behalf of the Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent 75,000 active and retired union members in our region, including many thousands of public employees. I want to thank Representative Coulter for working on this bill, and we're here to testify in support, specifically Subdivision 21B11, beginning on line 3.1 of the original bill. Our union represents employees of local governments, and our union staff often work with public employees and participate in the collective bargaining process or interact with local government officials as part of their daily duties in representing our members. This language, our frontline staff that do this work would never in a million years consider themselves to be lobbyists. They don't work on public policy. They don't advocate for public policy. They're simply engaged in the day-to-day business of representing our members and engaging in the collective bargaining process. And so this simply, this language simply clarifies that collective bargaining is not lobbying. We think it's common sense, and we encourage the committee to adopt that language.
Thank you for your testimony. Second on the list is Kate Klossner. Once you get to the table, if you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, good morning. My name is Kate Klossner, and I'm here in my role as legislative chair of the Minnesota Government Relations Council, also called MGRC. MGRC is a nonprofit trade organization that represents over 500 professional lobbyists here in Minnesota. Our membership is diverse, includes nonprofits, includes local governments, trade associations, law firms, unions, corporate lobbyists, who are all united in the support of one thing, and that's ethical representation at the Capitol. In support of this mission, we've had a positive working relationship with the Campaign Finance Board, and we commend them for their collaboration and partnership over the last few years if we work to clarify what lobbying is and what it isn't. And in the 2003 bill that expanded the scope of what lobbying is and what qualifies as official action, the statute has led to a lot of uncertainty among our members and among those who are in the lobbying community regarding what requires registration. And in some cases, there's been a reluctance to meet with public officials or to have our clients meet with public officials or local government issues. And so we support the changes that the representative has offered to better define what is and what isn't lobbying and to clarify what who needs to register as a lobbyist. And so we encourage that official work group to be formed and include members of the lobbying community from MGRC to ensure that a collective voice is heard on this ethical representation. We've also spoken to the bill author and to the Campaign Finance Board, and we encourage that during this time of the study that there is a stay or a pause in the new registration requirements, not in the reporting, not in current registrations, but in the new reporting requirements until this study is complete so that we can make sure that we have cleared up any ambiguity and we have defined what is and what isn't lobbying. That will ensure compliance and provide the opportunity to really adopt any recommended changes. This bill also adds certain exemptions, like you heard from the previous testifier, that are not MGRC driven, but we do not oppose. So we thank the representative and chair for your willingness to work with us on this, and we'll stand for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and one of the testifiers brought up not categorizing certain groups as being lobbyists, and since the Supreme Court and Citizens United recognized and strengthened the approval of some of those same groups to be able to lobby, I don't understand why we're having a definition that takes unions out of being considered lobbyists, since at the federal level they're recognized and protected to be able to do that activity. So that's my issue of taking selective groups out of being defined as, under any rules that we have for lobbyists.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can speak to that a little bit. I want to clarify that folks who lobby on behalf of unions would continue to have to register as lobbyists. They would still be lobbyists. What this language refers to specifically is folks who are, providing information or advice to members of a collective bargaining unit who are actively engaged in the collective bargaining process. So folks who support members of a collective bargaining unit as they are engaging in that process. It does not make any other changes other than that. And this truthfully was sort of a judgment call on my own part. If you look at the previous language on the bill, and we talk about providing information, data, advice, professional opinions, and so on, I sort of went back and forth on whether that would qualify under that language and thought it was just enough of a gray area that it needed a sort of specific call out. But to my mind, it sort of represents the same concept, which is that folks who are providing sort of professional expertise, their sort of professional experience, in this case, to folks in a collective bargaining unit who are working and negotiating contracts and so on, that really did not, it is not what I think most of us sort of think of when it comes to lobbying, because again, it's that sort of professional experience and that sort of thing. So just to clarify that that's what the language says and does, that it doesn't change anything with regards to actual lobbying.
Representative Qual.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my main point of doing the question was to get that clarification on the public record, because I could see phone calls and emails generated without it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Additional member questions, comments? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Coulter, closing remarks.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for your indulgence. I will say that, you know, this bill continues to be a work in progress, and I think the sort of initial goal here is to capture sort of the low-hanging fruit, the stuff I think that most folks would generally acknowledge, should or should not be considered lobbying. As I said, I think what's been revealed to me is that this conversation really is overdue, and has it happened for quite some time. And so I think this bill moves that conversation forward and really is an opportunity to discuss how folks interact with their government, and particularly so when they're being paid to do so. So looking forward to the conversation, and thank you again.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. With that, the bill is laid over. So the next two bills on the agenda are mine, so I'm going to hand over the gavel to Vice Chair Greenman. And if you could just give me a moment.
Should have like intro of the music. Very Mark Sundina. Okay. To move the bill.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So we'll do these two things all in a row. See if I get this right. This is my memo? No, it's not. Because the moment he's offering.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I will ask that House File 4243 be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're laying over House File 4243. You're moving to be laid over, and I understand you have a DE and an amendment. So let's do the DE first.
Sure. The DE1 amendment just matches the language up with the Senate. It adds in some exit polling language that was requested by the Secretary of State.
Thank you.
So I would move the DE1 amendment.
Okay. And then we are going to move, I think, the A1 to the DE before we vote on it. So do you want to just, Chair Freiberg moves the A1 to the DE amendment. Do you have anything you want to say about it?
Sure. It just deletes some language that was requested to come out by the Secretary of State.
Any discussion on the A1 to the DE? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Ayes have it. We also need to vote on the DE. Okay. With the DE as amended to the underlying DE, any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. I believe that we have the bill in the shape that you'd want it. Representative Freiberg, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was brought to me by Hennepin County. The changes in the bill are designed to improve registration and voting efficiency, increase the already high voter participation rates in the county by simplifying absentee voting procedures, improve and speed up the process by which votes are reported on election night, and bring Hennepin County's special election timelines and procedures in line with current state law, all while protecting the integrity and security of our elections. The Secretary of State's office approves of this legislation and has also included some language to help ensure that exit polling is conducted in ways that do not interfere with voters at polling sites. So that's just the brief summary, and I can turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Kristen Cepeda?
It's Cepeda.
Cepeda. Nice to meet you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Cepeda, and I'm the Operations Manager for Hennepin County Elections. Today I'm testifying in support of House File 4243 and wanted to highlight a few of the sections that we support. First, the online absentee ballot application. Currently, it's only open for state, federal, and county elections, and this bill would open it for local elections. Voters are really frustrated when they realize during a local election that they cannot request their absentee ballot online. Second, we support allowing a witness of an absentee ballot to be any U.S. citizen who is 18 years of age or older instead of the current requirement that it be a Minnesota voter. Many absentee voters are voting absentee because they are visiting a different state and often have difficulty finding a Minnesota voter to witness their ballot. We also support the section that makes changes to the results reporting options. Last year, the legislature changed the absentee ballot drop-off deadline of 3 p.m. to be 8 p.m. Due to that change, it's a challenge logistically to gather all of the absentee ballots that were dropped off at city absentee ballot locations and prepare them to report timely. Without this change, we fear that there would be a significant delay in results reporting in Hennepin County and have estimated that we might not be able to begin any results reporting until near midnight in November. With this change, we would be allowed to report the majority of votes and the number of remaining ballots we have left to count, and then add those votes to the totals in a supplemental update later in the evening. And finally, we support repealing the Hennepin County specific statute that governs the special elections of Hennepin County commissioners. This spring, we have a special election for a county commissioner, and due to the current statute, we're required to hold a primary just 2 weeks before the special general election. That shortened timeline makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for voters who are overseas to vote absentee. This repeal would allow Hennepin County to hold special elections that follow the regular statutes and timelines. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public that wish to testify? Seeing none, I think we can move to member discussion. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On 1.23 of the DE, is that meant to be township elections?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I believe town is the term that's defined in state law. I might defer to Matt Gehring on this one.
Matt Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Kwan, that's correct. The term we use in the statute is town.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that the word town is defined in statute to include both what we consider towns and townships. Okay.
Mr. Gehring, okay. Ned Hednand, any other questions or discussion? Representative Altendorf.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Freiberg, I just was wondering, so can you clarify then? So, I mean, basically we're not requiring them to register to vote. And is that then, does that open up any kind of doors of, you know, people that would be voting, you know, that might not be eligible to vote, you know? So is this removing the requirement to be registered? I guess that's my question.
Chair Freiberg, and I believe, are you talking about the witness requirement piece?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Or
sorry.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
No, it does not change the requirement to be registered to vote. An absentee ballot has to be witnessed on the envelope. So it's not related to registration at all.
Representative Altner, you good?
I'm good.
Sorry, I cut you off, Representative Quam.
That's okay, Your Honor.
Sorry.
On 312, one of the things that, and I understand the intent here, but one of the things that this brings up is what verification is there that this is someone that's 18, is someone that is a citizen of the United States, or is actually a real person? Because before in the system, having being a registered to vote in Minnesota, we had a record that we could verify. But with the current language, anyone could write anybody's name on there, and I don't see a verification process.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And I'm not sure if you want to take this, or I see someone from the Secretary of State's office. Nicole Freeman, choose your pick, Chair Freiberg.
I can take it, and okay. Nicole can help if need be. Madam Chair, Representative Quam, this would not change the verification process at all for checking the signature. Right now, the witness is signing an oath that they are a Minnesota voter, and this would stay the same. They would just be signing an oath that they are a U.S. citizen and 18 years of age or older.
Representative Quam.
So if I have an alter ego of Biff Periwinkle, and I sign that to go with my, the signature that I have with my given name on the ballot, I still am seeing that there's no verification about my alter ego, Biff Periwinkle. And if you look at in 2018, when they did an analysis, they did a sampling after they did the audit and registration system, there was a window that they took the sample from, and 2.5 years later, 45% of those weren't verified. So there is some documented concern about verification to begin with, but when you take away, at least we would have a data set that we could quickly cross-check to, but with this verbiage, we don't even have that. And, you know, again, you say it's verified, but you haven't given any process, what databases, characterization of the databases are, nothing. Just using the word verified gives me no comfort in my gut.
Mr. Chair?
Just a quick point. The penalty for violating the oath is a felony. So, I mean, that's a pretty big risk for somebody to take. And I just kind of wanted to bring us back to the purpose of this section. So a lot of absentee voters are voting absentee because they're visiting a different state, and they may, you know, they may be traveling for work by themselves. So it may be very difficult to find a Minnesota voter there if you're in California or Florida for work or something, for example. So this just kind of lines it up with their practical experience there. The penalties are the same. I mean, if you're concerned about that, we could certainly have a discussion about the verification process generally and what the penalties should be. But again, the purpose of this provision is just to ensure that people who are in another state have the ability to actually cast their absentee ballot, because we want to make sure everybody has the ability to vote who is eligible to do so.
Mr. Periwinkle.
Thank you,
Representative.
Madam Chair. The fact that this is happening in a jurisdiction outside of the control of Minnesota statutes even decreases the thought of there being penalties, plus the history of, well, first of all, if you really don't have a way of verifying, then there's no way you could ever bring any charges because you have no evidence because you never verified. I understand the intent is to promote accessibility, and it's generally for college students that are out of state that aren't going to be in the state of Minnesota for the, 46 days or whatever that you can actually in person come in absentee ballot or cast a ballot. But you're sidestepping the fact that there is no stated verification. Using just the word doesn't mean actual act. There's no documentation of how you would be verifying a person that's not in the state. So I find this a little bit disturbing. The intent I understand and agree with. The execution isn't there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Bliss.
Just nice. Real quick, how many people have been prosecuted for that?
Chair Freiberg?
Have we prosecuted anybody for that?
I might call Nicole Freeman.
And to clarify, Representative Bliss, when you say that, you mean?
The felony for attesting that you're a citizen and proven not to be.
Representative Freiberg or?
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. I think that is a knowable fact that we can get back to you on. I think that's what I'm seeing.
Yes.
Which will never happen?
Does the Secretary of State not have an answer for that? Wouldn't that be the people who do it?
The Secretary of State do not have a law enforcement on, so it would be the Attorney General's office or county attorneys, I would assume.
Mainly
county attorneys. Thanks, Representative Kwong. Any further questions? Representative Davis.
Yeah, I would just like to, I would think the Secretary of State's office, Madam Chair, would indeed know that information. Since they run the elections, that would maybe be something that they would really be paying attention to. We've asked that question before in committee and have not gotten an answer. So I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Nicole Freeman, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, thank you, Chair. As you stated, the Office of the Secretary of State does not have enforcement powers. County attorneys are required to report data to us. The data they report on the cases or the status of the cases is private. We have looked and have compiled some aggregate information, which I can share with the committee. I don't know specifically about the lying on the oath statute, but I do know that, in order to obtain it, you have to go and look through court records and, dig into each of the cases. So that's not something that we currently have a super efficient reporting requirement that's required. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Happy to send the data.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Representative Davis, any follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'd just like to point out, on our side of the aisle, that's what we're really concerned about, that we have people voting who are legal citizens of the United States of America. We've addressed this a lot, and we believe on this side of the aisle that the legislation that's being put before us and being pushed before us in this Democrat trifecta is not helpful in regards to that. We've seen legislation passed that we believe makes it a lot easier for, yes, legal citizens to go and vote, but also folks who are not here legally. So I just wanted my concern on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davis. And I just want to bring people back to the language, too, which this is about the eligibility, or this is about the requirements for the person witnessing, not the person voting. Mr. Chair, I'm seeing no further discussion, unless anybody pops up. Mr. Chair, final comments?
Thank you. I think these are common sense. Thank you for clarifying that. I was going to make that point as well. So these are common sense changes, and we're just laying this over. So I encourage the chair's support for laying this over.
House File 4243 is laid over. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your next bill.
Thank you. So this is House File 4772, and I will move that House File 4772 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Chair Freiberg moves. You have a few amendments. House File 4722, you're moving to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I believe you have a A2 amendment.
Yes, this language will conform the bill to the Senate language.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment? All in favor of the A2, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The A2 is adopted. There is an A1 amendment, and I believe this may be my amendment. Sorry. I move the A1, and just to note that this is a clarification to the electioneering provision language. It was never intended to be – the electioneering provision is about making sure we have transparency about folks trying to influence our election. True public opinion polling is not that. It's the opposite. It's folks trying to get and sort of assess public opinion. And so this is written to exclude public opinion research, but with language that we want to make sure that we are, if it's a push poll or if it's other sort of mechanism that's actually meant to influence voters, it would not be excluded. So that is what this amendment is. Any discussion? Chair Freiberg, what's your present on this amendment?
Oh, it sounds good. I think members should vote for it.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand the, but when you said push polling, a lot of the polls that are done by entities have leading questions that do influence the results. And I'm not sure if that is, they're all considered push polling. So I, you know, if there's some clarifying or improvement in the language to, you know, better focus down. Otherwise, I don't have an issue with the intent. I just know it's a tricky area that high-paid people are very involved in.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And we did not use the term push polling in the amendment for that reason. It says solicitation is not designed to influence respondents' view by presenting biased manipulative conduct. What this is intended to do is ensure that any poll that's designed really to present an influence to influence voters is excluded. It doesn't prevent people from doing it. It just means you have to report it if you do. So any additional questions or comments? All in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A1 is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. This is the vehicle bill for the policy omnibus bill that we're going to be discussing later tonight. Most of the changes came from the Senate and mostly in consultation with the Campaign Finance Board. It's following a slightly confusing process. I believe in the omnibus bill, I tried to have amendments adopted in the morning so that it conformed with the language we would be considering tonight, but I forgot the omnibus bill, which is posted on the website, is removed section 1 and 6. So those are in this bill, but they will not be there later tonight. Happy to take questions, but just so members are aware that that's what's happening. Then sections 2 to 5 and section 8 make changes to the electioneering communication statute that were requested by the Campaign Finance Board. I know Jeff Sigurdson is here and can speak to those some more. Section 7 fixes an error in the definition of major party to the language we passed last night. I do want to mention that this language does not affect who will be on the ballot in 2024. If you look at, and just to kind of draw your attention to why this is in here, because I know this is, at least last year, generated a lot of interest. on line 7.9 of the bill, it talks about a state general election held on or after November 7th, 2024. That was a bit of a drafting error for those who are paying close attention to the election. The election, in fact, happens on November 5th this year. So this is intended just to address that. As I said, it does not affect who will be on the ballot in 2024. So that's kind of a summary of the bill as it is, but the main purpose is to be kind of the vehicle for the policy omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. We don't have anyone signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify? Seeing no members of the public that wish to testify this morning, quiet morning, do I see any the member discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because of your efficient running of the gavel, we seem to be ahead of time. And I'm wondering if there's any background information that can be done before we recess to allow us to get a little ahead of the game, because after we have a good meal, we might be sitting down for a lengthy discussion. It's just a suggestion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I know how much you love spending the mornings with all of us. Are you suggesting that we get through this bill and then keep moving? Is there a specific thing you'd like me to ask the chair to clarify before we go forward?
I guess what I'm interested in, if we could, you know, we could probably do 30, 40 minutes of getting us informed and then recess, that then when we come back at 6, that we can start off with testifiers and, you know, get digging into the hard work of the bill. So I'm just saying that might shorten how late we go, and I'm going to be around here for a while anyway. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. That wasn't really to the bill, but I am going to ask you, the chair, and look at staff. Okay. Because we were not prepared for this evening until this evening, we want to make sure people have documents in front of them and everything before we go. So I think, well, not everybody printed stuff out on their own. You get a gold star this morning. Is there, before we move to the sort of rest of the day, is there any more discussion to this bill? No discussion to this bill. Okay. With that, Mr. Chair, House File 4772 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, which we will discuss this evening back at 6.
Yes. Yeah, and then we will go into recess right now, I believe.
So. Okay. We are in recess. I am going to reconvene us, so the committee will reconvene. And the only bill on the agenda tonight is House File 4772. Chair Freiberg moves House 4772 be placed on the general register. I think we're going to move the DE. Chair Freiberg moves the DE amendment, and then do you want to speak to your bill?
Sure, this is the DE3 amendment.
Thank you for that correction. Chair Freiberg moves the DE3 amendment to your bill.
Thank you. So this is our policy omnibus bill. It includes several bills that we've heard already over the course of this year, I suppose. So I think it's probably sufficient just to list the bills that are included here. So it's House File 4287, Representative Vernig's bill related to vacancies in the Office of School Board. House File 3632, Representative Hewitt's bill dealing with sheriff or county attorney vacancy fillings by special election authorized. House File 3557, which is my bill, the Secretary of State policy bill. House File 3447, Representative Purcell's bill allowing student governments to request a temporary polling place at post-secondary institutions. House File 4068, Representative Kraft's bill. Relating to pre-registration, which we heard this morning. House File 4243, which is my bill that was brought to me by Hennepin County that we heard this morning. House File 4679, Representative Coulter's bill, amending the definition of lobbyist. House File 4772, which is this bill, and it does include, the DE3 does include several provisions from them, which I described this morning. House File 3435, Representative Vernig's bill dealing with census activity. House File 4043, Representative Agbaje's bill relating to apportionment and prisons. House File 3625, Representative Stevenson's bill dealing with deepfake elections. Finally, House File 3527, your bill, Madam Vice Chair, the Minnesota Voting Rights Act. I think that's all the bills that are included in here. So happy to take questions, or we could maybe just move to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we are going to move to testimony before we take amendments. Starting with Nicole Freeman, Secretary of State, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Freiberg. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. I wanted to thank you all for the opportunity to testify today on the DE3 amendment. The amendment includes several pieces of legislation that will help improve Minnesota's election system as well as serve Minnesota's voters. Specifically, I want to highlight a few pieces of the amendment that will improve Minnesota's election system. The amendment includes clarifying the student voting list will be provided by a post-secondary institution, and that list can be used as proof of residence in conjunction with any form of ID currently permitted for election day registrations. The amendment also includes the option for an eligible voter to provide a physical address, a physical description of where they maintain their residence if they live in an area that doesn't include a 911 street address. The amendment strengthens the language access provisions passed in 2003 by this legislature that provide translated materials to voters on election day. It also includes provisions that allow voters to use the online absentee ballot tool in all elections except marked townships and instead of just state elections. Finally, it includes provisions that clarify who can serve as an exit pollster and require high schools to provide students eligible to register or pre-register with those applications. We want to thank Representative Greenman for her work on the Voting Rights Act. As Secretary Simon testified, it's important we pass something this session, and we believe the work that Representative Greenman and Senator Champion are doing with this legislation creates a strong Voting Rights Act for Minnesota voters, but also creates one that reflects Minnesota and our unique election system. I want to thank Representative Torkelson for working with us on the A11 amendment. We feel like this amendment provides clarity for election administrators and voters who reside in an address that lacks a street or 911 address. And finally, we request that you support the A18 amendment, which makes changes to the post-election timeline. These changes bring Minnesota into compliance with the Federal Electoral Count Reform Act. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify. And for your work this last session. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Next on my list, just walked in the door, is Matt Hilgert with the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. Tonight, I'm also testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Officers and the League of Minnesota Cities. We thought we'd try to consolidate our testimony to keep this thing going tonight. The two components that I wanted to chat about more specifically were both the Voting Rights Act, which Representative Greenman has authored and worked very generously with our organizations, as well as the post-secondary institution polling place locations. There should be letters in your packets that go over more of our concerns in greater detail. And so I will just kind of go a high level regarding the item on post-secondary education institutions of education being able to mandate cities and counties provide polling place locations. We have issued concerns about this in previous committees. What this means, especially with limited staffing and resources, is that if a county were to have, let's say, 10 or 12 different post-secondary institutions, and either their student councils or bodies or the institutions themselves requested these polling locations, it would not be realistic to think that the county or city would be potentially adding different polling locations to what they're offering in existing fashion. So we do have concerns about, one, what would happen in that case, and are we shifting polling locations from other communities to colleges' campuses? And two, which is, I think, a greater point of reference for our membership, is just we just made changes last year which provided flexibility to put these pop-up locations, and we'd like to see how successful we are in that before amending law to actually create this new mandate is what it would be. The second item is on the Voting Rights Act, and we have testified in this committee before on this issue. I want to thank Representative Greenman. She's been diligent in working with our associations. She spent hours even this weekend reaching out to us. She has made changes that are noted in this amendment, and we are appreciative of some of those changes. We would like to continue working with her and the Secretary of State's office. We are not in disagreement that we should not have a Voting Rights Act in Minnesota, or that we should not be sure to have a right of private action. We've been clear in testimony on that. What we want to make sure is that the law that we create makes sense, that we can understand it as election officials, that we are responsible for actions that we actually dictate, not just state statute, and that if there's a pre-suit notice process, it makes sense, and we're not holding counties, communities, cities on the hook for potentially several thousands of dollars worth of liability. So that is something we would like to continue working with Representative Greenman, advocates, and Senate co-authors on as this bill continues to see discussion throughout session. With those two items, I think I would pause if there are any questions for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Helgert. And I think our last testifier, Rod Adams, I do not see in the room. So I think maybe we would go to amendments. And if he comes, we can get that testimony in. But moving to amendments. Oh, thank you. Before I move on, is there any members of the public that want to testify? Seeing none. Chair Freiberg, I'm going to start with moving the A3 amendment.
Sure. We discussed this morning. I think we actually approved an identical amendment this morning already. This deletes the county auditor language from the Hennepin County provision. The Senate's removing that, and the Office of the Secretary of State is okay with doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any discussion to the A3? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Ayes have it. Motion prevails, and the A3 amendment to the amendment is adopted. The A5, I believe, is mine, so I will move the A5 amendment. And I will just notice we talked about this amendment this morning. This is the amendment that would exclude out of the revised electioneering language the use of non-commercial polls. We had a discussion about it. This is the identical language to add it to the omnibus. Any discussion to this amendment? Representative Freiberg.
Sounds good. Vote for it.
Thank you. Thanks. All in favor of this amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The ayes have it. The A5 amendment to the amendment is adopted. We're now on to the A18. Chair Freiberg moves the A18. Yep. And these amendments are in numerical order, so I think a few have been withdrawn, but we should be going in from smallest to biggest. Oh, you told me they were numerical order.
They are.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. They are in numerical order in your packet. They are not being offered in numerical order. But I will give you a minute and slow down.
What's the number?
We are currently on the A18.
Madam Chair, are we doing the A17?
It is my understanding that the A17 has been withdrawn.
Oh, okay. The A18 was referenced by Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office. Much of the language came from them. So it adds language clarifying that when post-secondary institutions send a county a list of student addresses, it's the most up-to-date information they have from students. It requires additional posting of information related to language minority districts. It adjusts the timeline of post-election activities to comply with the Federal Electoral Count Reform Act. It ensures that Minnesota's electors can meet federal deadlines to complete their duties as prescribed in the Constitution and federal law. And it makes a technical correction related to a reference to the U.S. Code.
Any discussion to the amendment, to the A18 amendment? Any discussion? Chair Freiberg, any final thoughts?
I'd appreciate your support.
All in favor of the A18, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. The A18 is adopted. Okay. Our final testifier, given we've been speedy, is here. So I think we're going to take a break from the amendments and have our final testifier on the bill, Rod Adams. If you want to come up and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Rod Adams. Okay. My name is Rod Adams. I'm the executive director of the New Justice Project Minnesota. We are a organizing hub. Sorry, I ran to get here. So I'm catching my breath. We are an organizing hub and a worker center that focuses on good jobs for the community, democracy, and housing for all. So we're partnering the We Choose Us Coalition. And the We Choose Us Coalition is a coalition of over 40 grassroots organizations and unions and advocacy groups committed to building a multiracial democracy in Minnesota. Take another breath. we write to share our support for the House File 4772 DE, the House Elections Policy Omnibus Bill, which includes many key provisions that will protect, strengthen, and expand our state's democracy. I want to thank Chair Freeberg for the inclusion of the following critical provisions in the House Elections Omnibus Bill. One, on-campus polling locations at post-secondary institutions. A proposal providing greater ability for college students to vote, reducing key voting barriers many youth face, and ensuring that young Minnesotans' voices are heard in our elections. Two, the Minnesota Voting Rights Act, House File 3527, Representative Greenman. Landmark legislation that will restore and clarify protections against discrimination for voters of color in Minnesota. The MNVRA is a prime opportunity to build our state's democracy, leadership, and stand firmly in support of the right to vote for all. And finally, the elimination of prison gerrymandering. In our state, which counts incarcerated individuals at their place of legal residency rather than their prison location for redistricting purposes. This will ensure fair and accurate representation for all communities, but especially work against the dilution of political power in communities of color. We thank you for your leadership and ask House Elections Finance and Policy Committee members to support and for their consideration of these additions to the bill. Thank you so much. Now I can catch my breath.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn it back or get back to the amendments. For clarity, the A19 has been withdrawn. So on the A23, the A23 is my amendment.
Madam Chair, could you just repeat that again real quick?
Yep. The A23. You are on the A23. Yep. The A23. I will offer the A23 and note these are revisions that to the language in the Minnesota Voting Rights Act that come from conversations over the last 2 weeks, both in committee and with stakeholders, with the cities and counties, with the Secretary of State, with advocates, and with civil rights litigators. Just a few things I'll notice. It refines the definition of voter suppression to closely track the Federal Voting Rights Act and existing case law. It reorganizes the pre-suit notice section just for clarity. It clarifies when fees are awarded, if there's a partial remedy. It replaces the rulemaking that was in the bill with just a more definite procedure for if there's remedies that require emergency or require polling place locations, and puts it into current statute for emergency polling place designations. And it revises the language around when statutory cities are allowed to move from at-large elections to wards, based on the great feedback from the League of Women Voters and the League of Cities, and tracks our current statutes around how to do that. So that is what this amendment to the amendment does. Any discussion? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like some clarification of how you're defining on 3.7 potential violations of section 200.54. How are you defining potential, and who are the entities that get to define potential?
Thank you. Representative Quam, and what this is just for folks, what this is trying to do is saying if there is a potential violation, if a local subdivision is given a pre-suit notice or notification, and one of the remedies to that would be potentially designating an additional polling place, that local subdivision is the body on the determining the potential violation. Mr. Chair, or Mr. Representative Quam.
I like your clairvoyance into the future. basically, my concern is because you've got earlier in that on 3.6, notwithstanding deadlines, so at some point past the deadlines, a lawyer or somebody files something with the local entity, is that sufficient to trigger, without adequate notice, polling places?
Thank you, Representative Quam. And this is meant to work the same. So this is building it into current law, the change of polling places in an emergency, which we already have built into law, and which gives the, and I may ask the Secretary of State's office for an assist just on how the language works, but it gives the local jurisdictions the ability in cases of emergency, and in this case, in cases of a potentially violating or finding a violation of voter discrimination, it gives them the ability to do that. What I will say is what it is meant to do is ensure that you don't, if you have a potential violation of voter discrimination, you don't have to go, one, you don't have to litigate it all the way out if it's just a polling place, adding to a polling place, or potentially moving a polling place within 6 months. But there are notice provisions that are included, including if the relocation occurs more than 14 days prior to the election, the local elections official must mail a notice to the impacted voters for the reasons of relocation and the location in the polling place. Representative Quam.
Yes, my initial question was the definition of potential violation. In other words, this would open up to a person deciding right before the election that they were going to submit that they feel there's a violation. And so there is no test whatsoever as to, the basis, validity, et cetera. So this would allow anyone to submit a letter saying, you know, you're violating, and with the appropriate legal references, and you would automatically have to do a new polling location because it's too close to the election to, you know, for anything like that. I think there that this is not quite developed enough, because I can see there being very problematic, especially if it's the day before a polling location would open. You know, you can't mail out notifications. You know, they're not going to be delivered. You know, those type of actually doing it.
Thank you, Representative Crum. And I just note that it's designating additional polling places, and so it would be in addition. But I will take. I feel like the language is clear, but I'm interested in talking and working with you. It's going in the omnibus bill, and so if you feel like there would be more clarity in terms of defining that, I'd love to continue talking to you about it.
Thank you.
Any additional comments, Representative Davis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So help me understand this on in the A23 amendment, line 1, 12 through 14. It says a violation of this subdivision may be established if it is shown that, based on the totality of the circumstances, members of the protected class have less opportunity than the rest of the electorate to participate in the political process or elect candidates of their choice. I think we did talk about examples, if I remember correctly, of this where this may happen, but could we just revisit that? Like, give me an example of where a protected class has less of an opportunity than the rest of the electorate.
Thank you, Representative Davis. And this is actually a good example of, since both the totality of the circumstances test tracks federal law. So a good example that we see a lot is if you have a polling place we have seen voting rights cases in other places. You have a polling place you set up precincts so that you have polling places that it takes much farther for you to get if you are in a black community to the polling place than it would potentially if you are in a white community. You have to really go to the totality of the circumstances. It's set up to be a very fact-specific analysis as you look through it, so I don't want to overgeneralize, but I think the reason we have some language that allows local subdivisions to take care of the polling place problem is because polling places is a good example. But again, I'd say that it is not satisfying for those of us who are sort of not in the litigation space, but it is a very fact-specific analysis, which is why it's a totality of the circumstances analysis. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, yeah, and if I remember correctly, we had a testifier testify to that very thing, correct? We had a nice lady testify that she had to walk like 12 blocks, I think it was, if I'm remembering correctly, to a polling place. So I'll just clarify. So that falls under this, correct? That example?
Potentially? This is where I would say the idea of where polling place placement is and if it has a discriminatory effect is in this. I don't remember that well enough to say to apply the analysis, and so I couldn't say whether that would violate.
I apologize if I'm not familiar enough with the bill, but let's say it is determined that situation does apply. It was discriminatory how far this protected class had to walk to get to a polling place, and we find that precinct is guilty of that. You know, what would be the penalty?
It's not a criminal statute. It's a civil one.
Oh, okay, sorry, I used the wrong term.
Yep.
But what would be done,
Representative? So the goal of this representative is to remedy the problem. And so in this case, the problem is that if there's a shown violation that members of a protected class have less opportunity or less access to that voting mechanism than the than members of the majority party or the majority population, then a few things under this bill. There's a provision for pre-suit notice, and so you could the party who thinks they have a claim could notify the subdivision, and the subdivision could remedy the situation with some of the tools in this bill. Or you could the subdivision could say, we don't think that this is a violation, and you could go to court and litigate it, and that would look more similarly to the conversations we've been having about historically about how the Voting Rights Act has worked.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm understanding it. So there's room for improvement, like to remedy the problem. If it's deemed that there's a problem, someone can come to the precinct or the powers that be and say, hey, according to statute, we have to fix that, this, and then there would be an opportunity to fix it before litigation would come. Is that making sense?
Thank you, Representative Davis. That is the goal. The goal is to create a mechanism that so that ultimately the goal is not litigation. The goal is to ensure that every Minnesota voter has equal access to in this case, to the right to vote or a person of their choosing.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Intent is very important, so thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the discussion reminded me that in between the 2010 and 2012 elections, Minneapolis had a elections bill, and in that bill it deleted the word two, which restricted the number of non-connected. In other words, if you have precincts and you're doing a polling location, if they're not adjacent, you're restricted to a maximum of two non-adjacent precincts being at a polling location. I objected to that then because you run into the issue of where it's farther away, and it could have a detrimental effect to some people. So you know, maybe if that could be looked at, we could avoid some of these issues by putting back in that limit, you know, that simple word of two. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And I would say if this bill gives us an opportunity to look at all of our statutes and just ensure that they are accessible, I think that that's a good, that is ultimately the goal, is to make sure that every Minnesota voter has unequal access. So I don't know the bill you're referring to, but I appreciate that comment. Any additional comments? Discussion to the A-23. Seeing none, Chair Freiberg, any comments?
I support it.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. All in favor of the A-23 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? All ayes have it. The A-23 amendment to the amendment is adopted. Moving on to the A6, Representative Quam, I think that's you. Would you like to move and describe the A6 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A6 amendment, and this is not the first time. It really bothers me we're one of three states and that the vast majority of people live where there's a provisional ballot ensures that no one is denied a ballot. And so this is to add in so that we actually comply with HAVA and that Minnesotans can join the other 97-98% of people that live where they can do a provisional ballot. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Chair Freiberg.
Thank you. Representative Quam, I appreciate your commitment to this issue. I think we would, you know, not be honest to ourselves if we weren't equally committed to the way we voted in the past. We have voted this down previously this year. I think this would adversely impact our Save Nay registration, which is a safe, secure, and voter-friendly way of voting, and it's a large part of why Minnesota has the best voter turnout in the nation. So I would encourage members not to support this, but do appreciate your commitment to this, Representative Quam.
Discussion to the bill, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm always confused when I hear someone say this would end same day, because Minnesota is just as capable as another state was when they had same day and provisional ballots. So this actually would not prevent same day registration at all. But I understand we'll have a vote, which I probably could guess, but I don't bet on things. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I mean, he actually took the words right out of my mouth, so I'll just double down on it. Yeah, you're right. It actually does not hinder voter registration. Provisional ballots just help secure our elections. It brings security, and not only that, but confidence. Again, I'll remind you that, and again, I spoke with an election supervisor on this, and that election supervisor warned me that's where the most fraud, potential for fraud, can take place, is on same-day voter registration. And so provisional ballots just help restore confidence in our elections, because people's confidence is shaken in our elections on both sides of the aisle, all over this nation. And so, Mr. Chair, I would ask that you would change your mind about this one. Thank you.
Any additional discussion? Chair Freiberg?
This amendment would allow voters to register the same day, but not to vote the same day. They'd have to vote provisionally, and I think evidence has shown that a lot of those ballots don't end up ultimately being counted. So I guess I would stand by my request that members not support this amendment.
All in favor of the A6 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay.
Yet.
The motion does not prevail, and the A6 is not adopted. A7, we've reached that time in the hearing where we're all speaking Russian. A7, Representative Quam, would you like to move and describe the A7 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would move the A7 amendment. And basically, this allows our electors to be decided both statewide, which would be the two that we get because of senators, but allows the individual congressional districts to decide who their elector would vote for. And this even more localizes the votes of our Minnesotans. And I think this is a very democratic thing for us to do in our republic, and that's why I'm moving that we add this to it. We would be, I think, the second state that, or is it, no, it's the third state. Oh my goodness, there are multiple states that have beat us to this, so but we can be there before Iowa. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I do share your "we should get places before Iowa" sentiment. Representative Freiberg, to the amendment.
Well, I was, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. I was chief author of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact Bill in the last session. So I appreciate any effort to change the Electoral College, because I think it's a broken system. However, I don't think this solves the problem which led us to passing the National Popular Vote Act in 2023. So I'm going to ask members to vote no. As you said, there are two other states that use this method, but that means by subtraction, there are 48 states, including Minnesota, that award electors on a statewide basis. And that's, you know, that's blue states, that's red states, that's purple states. You know, as long as we're going to keep electing the highest office in the land by a different method than we use for every other elected office, it seems like we just might as well use the system used in 47 other states rather than attempting a somewhat complicated and untested, aside from those two states, method. So I'm going to ask members to vote no.
Any further discussion, Representative Coulter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief note on this as well. Because this would allow electors to be put forward by congressional district, and because we do not have an independent redistricting process at the moment, this kind of system, I think, in the event of a partisan gerrymander in either direction in this state, would unfairly tilt the election perhaps differently than the state of Minnesota would be voting. So I think that is also a reason to oppose the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Any further comment? Representative Quam, you want to close any
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping Minnesota could lead. The one thing that this actually would do is Minnesota would get a lot of attention nationally, because in close elections, one or two electors could make a difference. And, you know, maybe when they're looking at us, they can notice all the wonderful things that we do in Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
Nay.
No. The motion does not prevail, and the A7 is not adopted. The next I have is the A8. Representative Altendorf, I believe this is yours. Do you want to move your A8 and describe the amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move forward the A8 amendment. With this, what it would do is it would change the 2 years remaining on the existing term to just a one term remaining on the existing term to allow those appointments on the school board, which we were talking about earlier in committee, so that on the 2 year, basically, that's 50% of their term is only served. So we think this is just a better reflection that it's a much smaller amount of time instead of a larger amount.
Thank you, Representative Alton. Representative Vernick, I believe this is your bill.
Yes, it is. And I would not support this amendment. It does not move the bill forward. Instead, it reverts back to old practices. By deleting the 2 years and inserting the 1 year, it no longer addresses the issues that we're trying to address in the bill, such as the cost of elections, special elections to school boards or school districts, excuse me. It does align the way it's currently written, aligns with the vacancy appointments in statutory cities. It doesn't address the low voter turnout. There's a lot of lack of clarity and confusion for voters in special elections. So, I would not support this.
Any further discussion to the amendment? Representative Altendorf, anything to close?
I have another amendment, so I'll just keep it spinning.
All in favor of this amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Nope.
The motion does not prevail, and the A8 is not adopted. Representative Altendorf, I think you have the A9. Do you want to move the A9 and describe the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move the A9 amendment. And as you know, we just talked about Representative Vernig, that one of the big problems with this, and when we heard the superintendents come to testify, is the cost, that it's costing the schools quite a bit of money, and that's one of the problems, you know, that we saw. And so on this amendment, we would that the appointee of the board shall serve until the vacancy is filled at a special election, which must be in conjunction with the next state general election or the next school board election. So this is then eliminating that extra cost that the school would be having for that.
Thank you, Representative Vernig. Any thoughts on the amendment?
Yeah. So again, I wouldn't support this amendment. It doesn't move the bill forward. It doesn't address the reality faced by school districts when they're running special elections. Those are expensive costs, and they do not require school districts to wait until general election cycle to hold school board elections. So a district still has the ability to hold an election if they wish under the way it's currently written. So, I would not support this amendment.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on 1.5 of the amendment, when I read in conjunction with the next state general election or the next school board election, that definitely would mean there'd be no additional expense to run a special election because it's an existing election already. And, you know, frankly, this wouldn't add an issue about, well, nobody's going to show up because it's only the special. This is saying it's when there's other things being voted on already, so you would have a greater turnout. I'm not sure with this language, though, if you would really change the effect of waiting for, you know, if it's more than 2 years, because this would generally happen within the cycle, so it'd be about that same cycle. But I don't know if there are some school boards that purposely have some on an odd number year. The ones that I'm familiar with are in even numbered years, and so yes, I with that verbiage, I don't see that you're going to have only a special on the ballot. So you would not incur the cost because you're already having those an election and polling locations open. So I would disagree with your interpretation of the language and the actual effect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Furnick.
Yes, there are quite a few school districts that run their elections in the odd years. So this would impact those school districts. And I know you talked about the 1 year versus 2 years. And when you appoint, so they can currently appoint, right? We all understand that. And they can serve for a year. This is allowing them to serve for less than 2 years, so less than half of the term. That gives the school community an opportunity to feel out that appointee. And if appointed, if you don't like the appointee, there is a process to petition as well. So there are some ways that you can address that, but at this point, I would not accept this amendment.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ernick. Representative Quam.
Maybe nonpartisan staff can clarify, because my reading of this in conjunction with, and even if the next school board election is an odd year, there would be already an election happening, so that with this language, you would not be causing an election unless there was already going to be an election. Is that interpreted? I want clarification on that.
Representative Crum, Mr. Gearing, are you clear on the question? Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm not sure that I have much to add beyond the base of the text that you're pointing to. It does require a special election to be conducted, and it does require it to be in conjunction with the state general election or the next school board election, which presumably, based on the wording, would mean the next regularly scheduled general election in the school district.
Thank you, Mr. Gearing. Representative Davis.
So, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Technically, it would be a special election on regular election day, just to clarify. Thank you, Mr. Gearing.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Final comments, Representative Altendorf.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And then just Representative Vernag, what I heard you say twice now on both of these amendments is that both of these amendments are not moving you towards your goal, or it's not moving you towards. So then we have to ask, well, what is that? Because the problem that I heard from the superintendents is the cost and what this is costing the school districts. So our school districts have been really burdened, you know, being on the education committee. They have 65 new school mandates that they're dealing with from the 2023 session that was just passed. Many of them really are struggling with not having these funds put into their general budget. And so things like a special election is becoming a really, really big burden on these schools. So I understand that. So getting back to my point, but you said we're not reaching our goal. Well, the problem is the cost. And now we are looking at ways of making this. What we're doing is we're allowing the board to appoint a new person to that board. And so it's like the problem is the cost. We're trying to come up with ways to help, lower that cost. But what's happening is it's causing a new problem, is We are taking away the voices of the people of the district who would be voting in the school board election. So we are essentially causing a new problem.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. All in favor of the A9 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the A9 is not adopted. The A10, Representative Altendorf, do you want to move the amendment and describe what the A10 amendment is?
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. We're just going to keep moving forward here. The reason why we have three amendments on this is because this truly is very problematic for our districts that we are silencing the voice of the people. We are not allowing a fair vote amongst the people, and I know we like to hear that democracy needs to happen. We hear this language quite a bit, and in this case, this is why we have the Third Amendment. So the A10, which I'd like to move forward, is so in the case, because we have now rejected A8 and A9 amendment, which are reasonable amendments, we've rejected those. And what the A10 would do is in the case that there are already two members seated by an appointment, that at that point we need to provide some sort of guardrail. So at that point, if there happens to be, which I'm sure this would be not super common, but at that point that would be filled by a special election. So we're not getting to any kind of situation where a majority of a school board is by appointee and not by a general election or by a special election.
Representative Vernick.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure what the problem is that we're trying to solve here so much. Again, I would vote, I would not support this amendment. It adds even more complexity to a process that's already difficult to follow. Currently, you are allowed to appoint or hold a special election. So we're not changing that component of this process. It's the amount of time the person is appointed to. So the appointment, again, as stated, if there is a concern with who the board appoints, there is a petition process you can follow. So for a variety of reasons, it doesn't take away anybody's ability to vote. Currently, districts are already allowed to appoint a replacement on the school board if a member resigns. School boards take the appointment process very seriously, and many create a fair process that includes applications and interviews and a public hearing. We are not afraid of that process, and I think it's a good one. It's been working. You might see, like I said, you might see longer appointments as a negative, but I see that as a positive. It gets the community an opportunity to see that appointed person, and they can vote them out. Or, as I said, if they have an issue, there is a petition process. So I would not support this amendment.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to point out as well that as Representative mentioned, the appointment process is optional. But I also just want to remind folks that appointments at the local level happen in city councils. They happen on county boards. This is not unique to school boards. And the process works. So I think we just need to be clear about this, that if we're concerned about the appointment process, then we need to be talking about city councils and county boards. And I just am not aware of that concern. So thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Altendorf, ready?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, we can just vote.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no. No.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the A10 is not adopted. The A11, Representative Quam, I believe you have. Would you like to move the A11 and describe the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the A11 is an amendment from a member that's not able to be here tonight. And so I'll do my best to do the description. This is to try and improve the identification and the correlation process when someone says, I live at X on the map. And I understand that the member did work with the author, And so I think the author understands the amendment, and I so move A11.
Thank you, Representative Quam, and I think I remember this from committee. Representative Freiberg, to the amendment.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for offering this, Representative Quam. I know Representative Torkelson put a lot of work into this. He worked with the Secretary of State's office to get the language right. We had a fair amount of discussion about this, I know, in committee about identifying the correct precinct for people who are unhoused, and I think this language is good and clear, so I would encourage members to support it.
Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails, and the A11 amendment is adopted. The A12 has been withdrawn. The A13, Representative Quam, do you want to move the A13 and describe the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically, the core principle on what precinct you are in is where you lay down to sleep, where your bed is. And frankly, I do not want to set a precedence that it doesn't matter where you actually sleep is your residence. And so I would delete Article 3 out of this bill.
Representative Agbaje, I think that this is your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. I guess I'm a little unclear in the description. The bill language that appears in this section is focused on reforming our allocation of how people who are incarcerated are counted when it comes to redistricting purposes or allocation of for the set number for people in districts. So as I've presented before, your residency actually does not change when you're incarcerated. So that's actually in our Minnesota Constitution, Article 7, Section 2, similar to as if you're in the armed forces or serving our country in another way. So I'm not entirely sure the reasoning behind deleting the entire section. But what we want to do is we want to follow 14 other states that have already started the process of ensuring that when they are counting folks, they're counting them to the district's census blocks where they belong.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Representative Quam.
Thank you. I'll forgive the slight of.
I did not mean a demotion.
the core principle is, you know, after a year, 5 years, 10 years, I don't know where a person will decide they're going to live. But when we're deciding what precinct are you in, that is where you sleep. And that's the way things have been set up. And that's, you know, basically, if you are distributing whatever, I'm not sure that we have, you know, when you do the census, you know, they're counting a past residence. There could be some clarification if you've got, you know, the home or, you know, I just, by principle, I think that this is not a correct following base core principles. If there is a addition or some special thing that's part of the redistricting, that would be a way of, you know, we could maybe look at it. The language just doesn't quite meet the standard, and that's why I'm moving this.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And I think the 14 other states that that Representative Agbaje referred to all have a process for doing this as part of the redistricting process with the data they've given. Any additional comments?
Madam Chair, just using the logic that was used on a previous amendment, if 14 other states are doing it, that means 36 are not. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Fair enough. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
The noes have it. The motion does not prevail, and the A13 is not adopted. The A14, Representative Bliss, Representative Davis, do you want to move the A14 and describe the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've been called much worse things. So, the A14 amendment ensures that Minnesota taxpayer dollars and direct appropriations by the legislature cannot be inadvertently used to fund campaigns or on purpose. Currently, legislators can write bills that fund nonprofit organizations that help them get reelected. This is wrong, and this amendment closes any loopholes that allow politicians and organizations to engage in pay-to-play campaign tactics. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Freiberg, the amendment.
Yeah, I have a few things to say kind of about this and about that characterization too. So nonprofits are already governed by federal law that dictates whether they can spend money on campaigns. So nonprofits incorporated as 501c4s, c5s, c6s can do political spending. Those are civics leagues, employee associations, labor and agricultural unions, and business leagues. Nonprofits incorporated as 501c3s cannot make political donations, and that's where our state, I think the state and direct appropriations that Representative Davis is mentioning are directed. And even where 501c3s and c4s are affiliated, the law treats them separately and is the purpose of that distinction. So under this proposal, a grant to a 501c3 would not prohibit a 501c4 from making political contributions. That gets kind of to a separate issue with this bill, and I think that's likely unconstitutional under the Citizens United decision. You know, under that, restrictions on political speech have to be the least restrictive means test applied by the Supreme Court when governments attempt to restrict speech. They would likely disapprove of a blanket prohibition on expenditures for any political purpose. So, you know, this sort of a piecemeal approach to spending restriction, that doesn't really get to the heart of the problem with money in politics. Citizens United and the cases it unleashed, I would say, need to be overturned, and the power of regulation should be returned to the people. There are still 13 spots left on, you know, if you recall early in the year, we heard Representative Holland's bill, which is a resolution to Congress calling on them to overturn Citizens United. There's still 13 spots left on that bill. It would allow Congress and the states to place spending limits on corporations, nonprofits, and unions. She offered to work with GOP members to find language they liked. We should encourage them to work with her and look forward to seeing your names on the bill. But just given the potential problems, I think, and the unconstitutionality with this, I would encourage members to vote no.
Further discussion? Representative Davis, you want to close it out?
So constitutionality, if I remember correctly, Representative Freiberg, that last year, HF3, the Protect Democracy Act, doesn't that violate the constitutional rights of corporations to give to, you see where I'm going with this, don't you?
Madam Chair, yeah, I think that litigation is still pending. I'd maybe turn it back to you, Madam Chair, if you want, since
you
were the author.
Thank you for making my point.
Representative Davis, I think that Representative Freiberg was saying is under the long line of cases, including Citizens United, there is a very narrow set of places that we can restrict that kind of spending. House File 3 had a very narrow prohibition against foreign influence corporations, relying on some of the jurisprudence that said you can't give, foreign nationals can't give, companies that are made up of or are influenced by foreign nationals and foreign entities also can't give. So it was actually a very narrow window, and I think that was the point that Chair Freiberg was making.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, but that does hurt American corporations, and that's the reason for the lawsuit, isn't it?
Representative Davis, I would say the reason for the lawsuit is that there's a set of corporations want to spend money in our elections regardless of whether it's constitutional or not, and so they're challenging the law.
Okay, well, I'll just focus on the language here. It's about direct appropriations by the legislature. That's for nonprofits. and any entity having direct influence on our elections, spending money on campaigns that will directly affect elections. Money that taxpayers' money, direct appropriations, going to that organization then taking money and putting it into campaigns. That's not right. So I would encourage a yes vote on this amendment. Thank you.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the A14 is not adopted. The A15, Representative Bliss, to your A15 amendment, want to move it and describe it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move the A15 amendment. Good news for everybody. We got a bill that's wildly popular. More than 80% of the country wants this bill. And interesting enough, 62% of Democrats want this bill. It increases election security, increases public confidence, and it would be a bipartisan add to the bill. So I think it's a no-brainer. Basically, it's requiring a voter ID at the polls. We would provide free voter ID cards in addition to all the other cards that would be available. You'd be eligible for just a voter ID card. We would also accept tribal government IDs and all sorts of different IDs. The vital records required to get these IDs would be provided at no charge at the county. So I think it's just a really good bipartisan bill. So, or amendment, if you'd care to take it, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Chair Feibrich, to the amendment that is bigger than the bill itself.
I know. I represent trees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bliss, for the amendment. I think when you mentioned the people who support this amendment, you left out kind of a critical group of people, and that's Minnesota voters, because they rejected the voter ID in the 2012 election. You know, voter ID reduces turnout by 2 to 3% on average. It excludes a large number of potential voters. 7% of citizens lack a government-issued photo ID. And in practice, it can have a discriminatory impact. So 13% of African-American voters lack photo ID compared to only 5% of white voters. And the application, of this doesn't always work as intended. Studies have shown that minority voters are more frequently questioned about voter ID than white voters. So I would encourage members to vote against this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the author stated many things that were used in the Crawford v. Marion County Election Board case. And that was a U.S. Supreme Court case, 2008. And in the testimony, the actual evidence that was presented indicated that all the groups that said this photo ID was going to disenfranchise had greater turnout and participation. And that's why Justice Stevens and the U.S. Supreme Court decided that photo ID was a valid way of improving the confidence in our elections. So I've got, a copy, to share with anyone that wanted to see that. But the assumptions actually didn't prove out in court, the highest court in this country. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Any further comment? Any further discussion? Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little clarification. According to a Star Tribune poll, it just says more than half of the people in Minnesota approve of voter ID, and 60% of African Americans support voter ID. So it's wildly popular. Thank you.
Representative Davis.
And just for clarification, and I'm getting tired, so I should have listened better, and I used to not pay attention to Minnesota politics. What year did you say that was on the ballot?
Mr. Representative Chair. Davis, I think you said 2012.
Correct. 2012. Thank you, Madam Chair. That was 12 years ago, And I guarantee you that people's confidence in elections in this state have greatly been shaken since 2012, which could lead to the reason why that Star Tribune poll has over 50% of Minnesotans wanting voter ID now. So here we have an opportunity to restore public confidence in our elections, because public confidence in our elections is shaken. That's a fact. Now, you can argue why that is. I'm not here to do that. The fact is, people's confidence in elections is shaken. So you can restore public confidence with voter ID. It would definitely do that. It would bring more security to our elections, not less. And here's the perfect opportunity to have bipartisan support in our elections committee right here, right now. And I know you could argue, well, we just accepted the A11 amendment. That was an amendment to make, in my opinion, a bad bill not quite so bad. Okay, so I wouldn't call that bipartisan support. This is an opportunity for real bipartisan support, where we shape and mold our elections to what Minnesota wants, and we hear from both sides of the aisle. We come together, we meet in the middle. Vote yes.
All in favor of the A15, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. No. The A15 does not prevail, and the motion is not adopted. I think we are on the last one, and I think it is yours, Representative Davis. Would you like to move the A21 and describe the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I would like to move that amendment. It strikes the language that has an enrollment limit for college campuses to have an additional polling place. Representative Purcell and her committee stated that the reason for choosing 1,500 students was because it would cover both schools in her district. 11 institutions would be excluded, while 45 other institutions would qualify. And I'll just note the list I have here. Thank you to our wonderful researcher, Jacob, for that list. At the top of the list, the second one on the list is Northland Community and Technical College, has less than 1,500, and that's actually in the district that I serve. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Purcell,
thank
the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think accepting this amendment is a statement of our values, that we should want all college kids to be able to request a polling place and have easier access. The research that I am looking at would include 32 more schools, approximately 14,000 more students. It's unclear how many of them are eligible voters, but I support accepting this amendment to the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Any final comments, or can I get to a vote? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Representative.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails, and the A21 is adopted. To the underlying DE, Representative Freiberg. Or any discussion now that we're on the underlying bill? Representative Quam, I see you got to the mic first. Wait, pause.
Go ahead.
Wait, aren't we going to discuss the DE?
Well, we're going to discuss it after.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So we're going to adopt the DE amendment.
Yes.
As amended, right now. Okay, that's what we're voting on. Thank you. Thank you, Simon. All in favor of adopting the DE3 as amended, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
The DE3 as amended is adopted, and now we can get to the discussion of the bill. Thank you for waiting, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and hitting a few of the different points. The last one, I don't think we've fixed the issue of multiple ballots at precincts that are based at the school because of the diversity of the residencies and addresses of the students attending. You know, I had brought up the fact that I've got a precinct in my area that has split. It has two different school districts that are in that precinct. And so therefore, they have to make sure they've got enough of those two ballots. But there are many examples of, on a college, especially if it's in a, you know, metro area, of where off campus you have multiple different, you know, precincts and ballots. And that doesn't include the fact that the official residence of the student can be at home, which would be a totally different ballot. So we had some discussion. I have not heard how they would ensure the availability of the actual ballot that each of the students should have at the precinct. So that is one of the things that I think needs a little bit of work on this. The discussion about school boards. Successful schools have the communities and the boards together. They trust, you know, the community trusts the board. And if there are too many appointments, that might cause a bit of friction. I know that there have been boards that voted to increase the levy without taking it to the voters. And that has upset the communities enough to where now they can't get any voter referendum passed because they've lost that trust. And the trust is not just the elections. The trust is when the school and the community trust and work together, the students do better. So that's part of the reason why that the last variation of, if you've already got two appointments, you've got to hold a special because you can't have that large of a portion that's made up of people that aren't directly relational and directly elected with the input of the people. I heard a lot of bragging about Minnesota's voter turnout, and I understand that. What confuses me then is that during previous committee testimony on the component bills going into this, there was a lot of testifying about localized turnout, about bad actors that are suppressing the votes of communities within their city or their county, that they aren't providing you know, interpreters to cover the language. You know, and I was surprised by that because I've seen, you know, in the third largest city where I'm near, a great deal of cooperation between local government and the different communities. You know, again, about 100 languages are spoken in the homes of the students of the Rochester School District. And we have communities working together so that we have interpreters for multiple languages available to make sure that we don't have those issues. So that's what some of this has surprised me about these different things that we've heard. But I think at a core of a lot of the frustration of the people sitting on this side over here is the fact that the scale should balance. We should come together on an elections bill in order to, well, first of all, things we agree on probably are really good things. I'm sure some of the things we disagree on are good things. But if we can come together and agree on, I think we've got a better bill. But what the public who watches and listens sees, that we have come together to do the best we can, that adds confidence and it tampers down the divisive back and forth that we hear in our communities. And that's part of the reason why we've had the history of coming together with bipartisan election bills. It shows that we can work together for the common good, and the confidence is better. And frankly, it's a little bit frustrating, but maybe I've been here too long and remember working together with a lot of people on the other side of the aisle and being able to do good work. But I don't want to be accused of postmortem abuse of an equine, so I will sit back and listen to the rest of the discussion.
Flogging a dead horse. Representative Altendorf, I also had that puzzled look on my face, so appreciate that. Representative Altendorf, do you want to follow that?
Wow, Madam Chair, that was a difficult one. I had to like process that. I just never heard that, you know, in that way exactly, so it took a little bit. But thank you, Madam Chair, for the time, and thank you, Chair Freiberg. For me, one big thing that I just hear over and over as I'm talking to people is just the increased costs that we're doing. So here in St. Paul, we continually do these state mandates that are statewide. That's really taking away local control. And as I've talked about before, every time we do these mandates, every time we pass mandates, it is adding to the costs of our counties or schools or whatever we're doing. So in this election bill, you know, we're doing things like with the voter registrations, absentee ballots, the pop-up booths, and all of this is going to take more time, more staff, more training, and, you know, kind of like untold costs that we really don't know what this is going to cost at the county level. So for me, that really is a concern that I do wish us as here in St. Paul, we would give more consideration to this, that as we are writing these laws and forcing these mandates, that there is a cost to our local entities that have to do them. So what I really would like to see is more bipartisan support, and I think the voters of Minnesota, you know, we want to be very confident in our vote, and we want to just really make it easy to vote, hard to cheat. And I don't think that's too much to ask. So that's where my concern is that we're not working together in the state of Minnesota right now. We're not working together to make sure that we can say, I mean, wouldn't it be great to come out of these meetings and say this bill has bipartisan support and really be cheerleaders for the state of Minnesota and all of us on both sides to say go out there and vote, and it just doesn't have it.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf, and thank you. I think when we get to the budget bill, we'll have the voter fund piece that hopefully will provide more resources for our local elections officials, because I think that that is a priority we all share. Representative Davis, you're next on my list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a lot of issues with this bill, a lot of things I'd like to talk about, but maybe Representative Freiberg or Mr. Chair, we will have that battle, that discussion on the House floor one of those nights going till midnight. We'll see. One thing I do want to just bring up right here in committee is, I'm hearing from the other side, we're just trying to make elections fair and equitable. But then you're the ones that are setting the rules for what you think that looks like. Like, that's what I heard. We just want fair. We want fair elections for everybody. We don't want anybody to be discriminated against. But yet, there's only one side who are setting the rules for that. Like, for instance, when it comes to redistricting. Redistricting needs to absolutely have bipartisan support. But what I want you to see is you're the only ones who want to set the rules for that and what you determined as fair and equitable. And you're shutting out the voice of the other side. So that's not bipartisan at all. We need to have bipartisanship in this bill. We need to restore the public's confidence in this bill, and we need to restore security in our elections in this bill. And so I would ask that we, this committee as a whole, would change their way of thinking and go a different direction and listen to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, I'm going to turn it back to you, Chair Freiberg, for any final comments.
Well, thank you. I'm glad, Vice Chair Greenman, that you mentioned the issue of the voter fund, because I do think that will help address some of the costs that Representative Altendorf mentioned, but I feel like if I brought that up now, I would be flagellating a stallion that has shuffled off its mortal coil. So Representative Quam, that one was for you. So this is a good, this includes really good bills, I would say. It corrects historical wrongs and federal mistakes. I mean, I think the inclusion of the Voting Rights Act in here is a big deal, and I'm really glad we were able to do that. And I appreciate your work, Vice Chair Greenman, continually refining that to make sure it meets our needs. The bill will improve the clarity of who and how our elections are influenced. It will expand voter access and voter understanding. I think those are goals everyone shares. You know, we may not always agree on exactly how we go about it, but I do think, you know, most of these provisions have, if you just ask your average Minnesotan on the street, whichever party they are, I think they are provisions with bipartisan support. So appreciate your consideration, and I would ask for members' support.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. And I believe that, Representative Quam, you're going to ask for a roll call. Okay. A roll call being requested. I'm going to turn it over to you to do a roll call. Oh, thank you. Chair Freiberg renews the motion that House File 4772, as amended, be placed on the General Register.
Chair Freiberg.
Yes.
Vice Chair Greenman.
Yes.
Minority Leader Torkelson is excused. Representative Agbaje.
Yes.
Representative Altendorf.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Coulter.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Frederick. Representative Purcell?
Aye.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Vernig?
Aye.
With a vote of 8 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. House File 4772, as amended, is placed on the General Register. And with that, I believe we are long day of very nerdy conversation. We are adjourned. Thank you.